I wanted to go over, let's go ahead on what you have prepared for today. I did want to note two things. One, that I'm interested in how you prepared. And then secondly, I wanted you to reflect, but maybe not today, on what your image of China was before you took the position and what your involvement in China had been to that date. If you want to talk about that today, fine, or if you want to think about it, fine.
Well, I'm not sure that I can recall what my image was of China at that period. My interest in the whole area, of course, was very much intensified by the Vietnam War. In the early days, very frankly, I was a strong supporter of the war and believed the notion of containment. Sharp clashes in my family because my two daughters, in particular, were from the very beginning in sharp opposition to the war. Although I fell by the wayside as far as being a supporter is concerned. An early date. Well, probably as early as S-66 when our numbers kept escalating and it was pretty obvious that South Vietnamese would not fight for themselves. It seemed to me a pretty elementary proposition that people will not fight for themselves if they don't have a cause that they really believe in. And along with that, of course, went a much different reconsideration with regard to China.
Had you thought much about foreign policy or about East Asia during your UAW days before the Vietnam War?
No, not particularly. Because the beginning impact of Japan as an automobile competitor and the Vietnam War sort of went together.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese had begun to come into our market in the late 50s, but they essentially withdrew in 61 because they were not doing a very good merchandising job. And they were sensible enough to withdraw, to replan, and then come back in force, and very successfully, as we know. So my involvement with Japan, which was in terms of visiting and exchanges, really began with 1970 when I became president, and I worked very closely with Ichiro Shioji, who then was the head of the Nissan Union, but who was seeking to build a confederation of the various unions, which was finally accomplished October of 1972. And that union was copied after the OAW, mm-hmm. even to their little, their insignia. They have little emblems that, in Roman lettering, J-A-W instead of U-A-W. I might say that I went to Japan for their founding convention in October of 1972 and spent...
Was that your first time in East Asia?
That was my first time in East Asia. I spent quite a bit of time there. And I remember the opening session. All the representatives of the governing party, the Socialist Party, the Democratic Socialist Party, Cometo, and they were all referring to something very bad that happened in 1954. And I couldn't, from the translations at least, I couldn't figure out what it was that happened in 1954. I spoke at that same opening session. And then after I went back to the hotel and Shioji came over, I said, what happened in 1954? Well, it seems that they'd had a very bad strike when the military occupation came and MacArthur began to look around for social forces that were anti-militarist. The only ones you could find were the communists. So the communists were allowed to head up the labor movement. And they had an industrial union in Ottawa. And they called a strike, which lasted almost 4 months, which would be an unheard of thing today in Japan. And it was completely smashed. And then the unions were reestablished enterprise by enterprise, but there was a union in Nissan, another in Toyota, and Isuzu, and so on. I said to Shioji, we must have had a dozen meetings. He'd been to the United States, I'd met with him in London, I'd met with him in Geneva. I said, why didn't you ever tell me this? Well, he said, you never asked me. But I spent quite a bit of time, some 3 weeks in Japan at that time. And toured all over, and I found that representatives of the Japanese unions were very, very self-conscious of this stigma of company union. So when I became conscious of this, I used to talk to them the UAW, in essence, is a federation of unions. We have a union in General Motors. We have another union in Ford and International Harvester and so on. And that we wouldn't dream of striking all the automobile companies at one time, because that's a strike you can't win. We didn't produce all passenger cars for 4 years in World War II, and the nation still stayed on wheels. And they would brighten and smile when I told them this. And so, through them, I began to get some glimpses of China, mm-hmm. particularly in meetings with Soyo leaders, because they were close at that time to the Chinese. But it was not a very, and I must confess, it was not a very sharp image in my mind, but I did get the strong impression that China was not the threat that imagined and on which we had really based the validity of our military participation in Vietnam. I did feel strongly, even before that time, that that we should have there should be normalization of relations between
that
us.
Probably must have had that feeling going back into the 50s even.
Yes, right, right.
But that would just have been a more, just based on a more liberal interpretation of American foreign policy.
That was what readings I'd done about the nationalists and Chiang Kai-shek. Well, it wasn't unique to be suspicious and leery of Chiang Kai-shek in those days as far as the liberal community was concerned. As you know, President Kennedy had asked me to if I'd be interested in going to Taiwan as ambassador, and that was in...
No, oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. That was in 1961. He had, before that, asked me to go to Pakistan. And I turned Pakistan down, and then they approached me about Taiwan.
Had you been an early Kennedy supporter?
Yes, yes.
At that time, you were what, vice president of UAW?
I was vice president. But I was also chairman of the, no, didn't go back that far. Later on, I was chairman of Michigan CAP, that is the political arm of the UAW. I became involved with Jack Kennedy, if I may digress. We had a convention in October of 1959 in Atlantic City. And we invited to that convention the leading candidates on both the Republican and the Democratic side. Mr. Nixon did not come. Lyndon Johnson did not come, although he was invited. But Symington came. And Humphrey came, and Kennedy came. Humphrey came on one day, and Kennedy the next. And Hubert Humphrey just took him by storm. In fact, it was impossible to get the convention back to order after he had him on top of the table. He really took it by storm. I had asked Walter Reuther if I could introduce Kennedy. Now, I did not do that because I had any particular regard for him. But that was the year the Landrum-Griffin Act was passed. And the bill that passed the House was a very vicious bill. The bill that passed the Senate was, although it put into place reforms which labor by the behavior of at least some of its parts had asked for. And of course the two bills then went to conference. Kennedy was a ranking member of Labor and Education, and he was on the conference. And he worked extremely hard to get the worst things in the House pass bill out of the conference bill. But he was under very unfair attack as having espoused this anti-labor bill, as it was called. Slave labor bill was some of the absurd rhetoric that was used. And in some circles, it was known as the Landrum Griffin Kennedy Bill. And I felt this was so unfair, and there was some inside our own union who shared those sentiments, that I asked to be allowed to introduce him. As a matter of fact, I watched the first couple of days of the convention. There were the center aisle and two side aisles. We came to the conclusion we'd bring him over on the aisle to the right of the platform, the left of the platform as you face it, rather than the other side, because there was a whole pocket of anti-Kennedy people. I had breakfast with him, along with the committee, the escort committee. Then he and I were left alone, 15 minutes, no more, in which I asked him if he really thought it were possible for a Catholic to be elected president of the United States. And the simple way he answered it, that he would know that, he was pretty sure, whether it was an impossibility or far-fetched possibility, by March, April. And there are other ways in which he could serve his country. But that conversation enlisted me in his cause, and I worked very diligently for him after that, and was a Kennedy delegate at the 1960 convention. I also got to know during that period Ted Sorensen very well, because one of Ted's assignments was Michigan, so that he and I worked very closely. So it was because of this background that I was first asked to go into the Commerce Department, which at that point anyway, I had no particular desire to go into government. I might say that when I was called on the second and last time about Taiwan, I went into
Who called you? President Kennedy himself? Were you narrowed down, or was this an expression of whether you would be interested, or whether you...
No, this was a definite proposal, but it did not come directly from the president.
Who called you? Do you remember?
The name slips my mind. It was one of his personal staff.
From the White House?
From the White House staff, yes. And then afterwards, another one of the White House staff said, the much sought after and unwilling Mr. Woodcock. But I went down to, just for the heck of it, to tell Walter Ruth what had happened. And he's sitting in his desk, and he had a chair on casters. He shot up out of his chair, and the chair banged against the wall behind him. He said, Jack Kennedy's out of his mind. I said, you're not very flattering. But then he went on to say that, which was correct, to get along with Chiang Kai-shek, it had to be a conservative and not someone else. But I'd had a continuing interest, but not an intense interest in...
So in other words, though, that 1916 counter meant that the thought of your being an ambassador had at least been planted in your mind and on an earlier occasion.
Yes, I suppose so. Nothing frankly that I was conscious about.
Yeah, but it just, yeah, okay. Now, what in the 2 hours last session, you also said that in effect you decided that you would accept the offer in 4 or 5 hours, that the call came somewhat out of the blue, and at dinner that night you'd already decided that you wanted to take it. What led you with such rapidity to decide this was something you wanted to do?
The challenge, I think. It revolved around the hope for normalization.
So that as a result of the Vietnam War, as a result of your experience in Japan, you understood the challenge immediately and decided that you wanted to be part of this history.
Right.
Did you have a sense that that Carter was committed to normalization, or were you just taking a flyer on it? Was there any policy discussion with Carter when he called you up?
It had been conveyed to me by Dick Hoper that that was a goal for President Carter, normalization.
But as I recall, Dick at that point really had no special insight into the president's thinking on this issue. It was a hope, but whether it was really a high priority of the president or not was not known to Dick.
Oh, it was not. It wasn't conveyed to me that it was a high priority. No.
So you were just hoping that you could be influential and help bring it about, even within the administration.
That's essentially correct, yes.
So that you saw, I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but was one of your considerations then not just that you would be working on this with the Chinese, but working on it within an administration as well?
Yes, I think there was even conversation to that effect after the event, that it was hoped that my closeness to the president would aid in bringing into focus the possibility. But I don't think that was very much in my mind in those 4 or 5 hours.
On our side, I remember discussing in the State Department your nomination, and we had that thought that the Chinese would appreciate having a nominee who was close to the president, and that it would also help us, Dick and myself, a couple others, were certainly committed to normalization, but we had no sense the final analysis, how big or size stood. In fact, my first conversation with Brzezinski in February, March, after I'd accepted the job, was a discouraging one insofar as his immediate commitment to normalization was concerned. I felt I had an educational job was big and that it took at least 6 months before he was willing to say he was for normalization.
I think you and I had some conversations about that. On the occasion of my first return in the fall of 1977.
That's right. At that point, what he was trying to do was everything but normalization. He'd like to move ahead in a whole range of other areas, if possible, without confronting the main issue. But that remains for us to talk about later. In that sense, at the earlier stages, Cy Vance was probably more for normalization than Zbig.
I think that's true, yes. Although not a high priority.
That's right. Right. Well, let's get on to
Other thing. When I was a young man, I had been very active in the Socialist Party. During the days of the Long March, I read a great deal about China and the Shanghai Massacre of 1927 and all of those developments. So the interest was political rather than in the country as such. So that the miracle, that's really what it was, of that long march was what, it's 30,000 survivors, although I must have met 300,000 who were in the long march during the 4 years I was in China. Made quite an impression on me in those days that to have accomplished that over that tremendous distance, and that they had to have at the very least the benevolent neutrality of the peasants, so that I was not a student of China, but I followed China closely in the normal ways in which information is available to newspapers, magazines, and so on, or books, so that I was not a complete innocentola, but not by any means an expert.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
so you've gotten the call. What happened?
It was first announced publicly, although it was public knowledge, but it was not announced formally until President Carter came on the to speak to the UIW convention in Los Angeles on the 17th of May. So that he announced to the convention of the world at that time this was that he had asked me and that I had agreed. So that my term then ended that week of the convention, because UIW elects its officers through delegates at the convention. There's an immediate turning over to the office. And then the following week, which would have been the last week of May, I began going to the State Department to read everything they would give me. Try to meet as many people as I could who could help me with an understanding of China. One of the first, I had lunch with the Pakistani ambassador.
Who had been in China.
Who had been in China and who was involved in 71.
Right.
And he was very useful to me insights. And that also was useful to me when I later got to know the Pakistani ambassador in Peking.
Do you remember that man's name? I can't remember, and I met him too.
No.
Was he still the ambassador, or was he the former ambassador?
Well, he was the ambassador.
The acting, the current ambassador.
At that time, in 1977. Now, at this point, it was before that. It was even before the convention. I am spending a great deal of time in Washington on the legislative fight for changing the Clean Air Act with respect to mandated emission controls for automobile engines. And the numbers that we had worked out conjunction with the David Rigoni, dean of the engineering school here, and which Ford came to accept. General Motors finally and reluctantly, but were not the same as the numbers that the administration was supporting. So that I was working very hard in both the House and the Senate against the administration proposal. Yes, this had to be before the convention because I sent word to the president through Hamilton Jordan that I had to pursue this because I was convinced that what we were doing was proper, but it well could be embarrassing to the president, and that I was perfectly willing to have my name withdrawn. And he sent word back that he understood and that was no problem. In fact, he made a reference to it in his remarks at the Los Angeles convention, so that it had to be before. It was after it was made public, there were two men in particular who very much wanted to be deputy chief of mission. One was Henry Saylor, who I'm sure you know all of, not know.
I know him.
Who was a well-paid Washington lawyer. And then when later on I informed him that there was no vacancy, but that post, of course, plus there was a slot on the staff for a personal aide to the ambassador, with the only two on which I had any direct influence. He wanted so badly to serve in China that he was prepared to take the post of personal aide without even knowing what the salary would be, and of course it was a far cry from what he was getting. And the other was a man who had a very questionable reputation.
From California,
from Los Angeles.
Yes. A classmate. He actually was a friend of Saylor's and of Lucian Pye's. I'll think of his name in a minute. Go ahead.
He was very persistent. He sent me all kinds of materials. He came to
China. He hustled the Nixon administration, too.
Yes. He claimed to be an expert, to have all sorts of insights. He visited China while I was there, but made no reference at all to that past. So I spent many days in June in the State Department. Reading everything that was given to me, some of which didn't make much sense. I mean, the reading didn't make much sense, but it wasn't really needed, the stuff. They were just trying, I guess, to keep me busy.
Well, but you had read the entire Kissinger, Nixon, Memcons, the 71
transcripts,
plus
and 75.
But did you? My understanding from Harry Thayer, who was then the desk officer, is that you were reading each of the Kissinger trip Memcons too, 72, 73.
Yes, all of that. That was very interesting.
Yes, I remember. I had gone through that in March, I think.
Also the cable traffic. I remember one cable in particular where Gates had said that he was, at his convenience, planning his next trip. Oh, somebody had circled that with exclamation marks in the margin. That he would plan it. But all of that was very useful.
What was your reaction, as best as you can recall, to those conversations?
Well, I remember thinking at the time, as I was reading some of the, that Dr. Kissinger phrased things in a way which I thought was not very dignified on behalf of our country. It wasn't obsequious, but headed in that direction.
We are speaking for a record that will not become public for some time, so I can tell you what President Carter's reaction was. I sent selections of those to him, and I felt on balance that Kissinger had done brilliantly, although there was this playing to a Chinese image of the world as part of his strategy. And I remember Carter's response to Brzezinski, because Brzezinski took the memo that I had written and sent it forward under his name. Carter sent back a note saying, "I don't think that Kissinger did well at all. He just kissed their ass."
I guess that accounts for the fact that in my last meeting with him, and you were there, how emphatic he was that shouldn't kowtow, in effect.
Exactly. That was when you went, just before your trip, you met with him. That's right, and that was one of his... But that's the reason.
No.
That's right. He had gotten that from the record, and it concluded that.
Well, I think that I share your belief that the whole affair was brilliantly handled. And certainly the Shanghai communique was a masterpiece. But I just think his tone was unnecessary.
Well, particularly about the Soviets. I think that he subscribed far too rapidly to the Chinese view of the Soviet Union, when we know that on the Moscow side, he was simply subscribing to the Soviet view of the Chinese.
Yeah. You know, when Kissinger came to China, I joined him at the small dinner that Deng Xiaoping gave for him, so that I was to Deng Xiaoping's left and Dr. Kissinger on the right. And Kissinger starts to talk to me about the difficulties with the Shanghai communique and how after it had been all worked out and agreed, it had, of course, to clear through the bureaucrats in the State Department, those nitpicking muddleheads, you know, talking this way about a department which he had headed in front of the leading
yes.
personage in another country, it seems to me, is, again, unnecessary and in pretty bad taste.
Right, he disparaged several Americans to the Chinese and showed, if you remember, he also showed memos to the Chinese that he had received from the State Department.
I didn't know that. Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
Yeah, that's in one of the MCONs.
Yeah. I see that Arthur Hummel, I had a meeting with him. It was a very brief meeting. He sent word he'd like to see me. I'd never laid eyes on him before. He walked in and said, if it weren't for you, I'd be going to Peking.
Is that right?
I said, well, I'm sorry about that. And then he said, well, I'm off to Pakistan, and I do want to be in a position to tell them that I know you, since you'll be, in effect, my neighbor. And subsequently, of course, we got to be pretty good friends. I also had a very useful meeting with Tom Gates, who was my predecessor.
Very honorable man.
A very honorable man, and he was most emphatic on the need for normalization. And he was the one, his message to me, in effect, was, you're supposed to be a pretty good negotiator, but there's nothing to negotiate. There it is. We're either going to do it or we're not. We're not going to do it. And then I spent a great deal of time in talking to people in the department, of course, who had to do with China. Joe Duffy then was head of the Cultural Affairs section, which subsequently was moved over to ICA, and met with people from the National Committee, met the CSC, Charles Cross was then our Consul General in Hong Kong. I had meetings with him, and spent the better part of one Saturday in June here in Ann Arbor with the meeting that I'd asked for with Alan Whiting, Bob Dernberger, unless someone else there, a younger person. Well, maybe it was just the two of them. Peter Eckstein, who lived in Ann Arbor and who was on the UAW staff, helped arrange that. And the department brought David Dean, who was then the DCM, home so that he and I would have a chance to meet. And I found our meeting quite satisfactory, particularly with the rough edges on me. It seemed to make sense to leave him in place so that there'd be a continuity. I visited commerce and agriculture. Just learned as much as I could in those directions.
This was all in the month of June, rather busy schedule.
Right. And also on the 16th of June, I went and saw the president of the White House, but this was not with China. This was on national health insurance, because I was still the chairman of the Committee for National Health Insurance. And we were discussing the bill that the administration was going to send up, which didn't go up for quite a while after that. And then that same day, I resigned as chairman, but on that aspect, there was no, the administration and the Committee for National Health Insurance were on the same wavelength. It was only subsequently